In the 1930s and early 1940s, prominent Americans publicly endorsed a policy of America First, even if that meant turning a blind eye to the violence done in Europe by fascist political parties in Italy, and especially Germany. Today's guest argues that American fascism has roots that go back to the end of World War I and is joining a new dynamism today. He's Christopher Viles, this week on Story in the Public Square. Hello and welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in historic Newport, Rhode Island. I'm joined as always by my friend and co-host G. Wayne Miller, an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal. Every week, we explore the stories and storytellers shaping American public life. Today, we grapple with a ghost of Western history, fascism. Joining us is Dr. Christopher Viles, Director of American Studies at the University of Connecticut, and author of Haunted by Hitler. Chris, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
So let's start with just something really basic.
Sure.
What is fascism?
Fascism is a particular movement within the political right. It's not synonymous with conservatism or synonymous with the right generally. It's a specific strand of it. And specifically, it's not so much elites wishing to preserve their property and economic power so much as it is a middle class movement guided by a desire for national renewal along the lines of race, nation, power, strength, and really aimed against national minorities and the political left.
So Hitler and Mussolini, two giant historic figures,
right,
who were fascist.
Right.
But you're not specifically talking about the German fascist movement or the Italian fascist movement. You're talking about a particularly American strain.
In my book, yes, but it's important. One of the things that I make a point of saying in the book is it's important to remember that fascism is not something that's just confined to European history pre-1945. It was a global movement, and it still is a global movement. But it had American strains as well, and American strands dating from the 1920s, and it had the American rightist fascist movements have impacted American life at a number of really critical junctures, and not just, and I wasn't really looking just at fringe movements or fringe groups, although those are there and those are important because they terrorize people, but movements that could be characterized as the functional equivalent of fascist movements that have impacted American politics and American life.
I want to get to the American version of fascism in a moment. What are the historical roots before the 1920s, or is that the historical root of fascism? Does it predate that? Or?
Yeah, I mean, historians are not of one mind on this. In the historical literature, one of the more compelling arguments that I've seen is that fascism is in Europe. The seeds of it in the late 19th century was a blowback from colonialism and racial consciousness and forms of racism, basically, that were born of colonialism. And even colonialism changed the nature of anti-Semitism in Europe, too, from the kind of Christian-based anti-Semitism that was prevalent in the Middle Ages, where the Jew was a sinner who could be converted, to the Jew as a racial other, who there was no possibility of redemption. Right, and that was a much harder form of anti-Semitism that came about as a blowback from colonialism and a blowback from Darwinism, social Darwinism as well. Those are some of the kind of the deep roots of it.
So was it a school of thought at that time as opposed to an active political movement? Again, looking at the late 19th century and then we'll get into the 20s here in America.
I mean, in Europe, it's a strand, right? It's a strand of thought that doesn't really cohere into something we would call fascism, really, until the 1920s with Mussolini.
Okay.
But in the late 19th century, yeah, you have the eugenics movement, right, and eugenics discourses, and the strands of masculinity and strands of racism that are accompanying that. That are, and you know, you have authors, you know, even earlier than that in Germany, like Gustav Freytag, and you have Dalton's eugenics, and these things are kind of feeders into it. But again, they don't really cohere into something we'd call fascism until the 20s. But it's the important thing to remember about fascism is it seems like it's archaic, it seems like it's barbaric, it seems like it's ancient, like ancient prejudices, but it's distinctly modern, right? It's something born of distinctly modern politics.
So American audiences, I think, are used to hearing about European fascist movements, sort of the cult of World War II and the celebration of that generation of American heroes sort of is a reaction to the rise of fascism in Europe. But there is a fascist movement in the United States beginning in the 1920s.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to us about that history.
Yeah, I mean, the first fascist mass movement in U.S. history was the Ku Klux Klan that arose in the 1920s. That was, you know, there was an old Klan that was in the Reconstruction, but then it was reborn in 1915, and it was actively aligning itself with Mussolini's Italy, right? Although for them, they, you know, the American Klan hated Italians, so that presented a problem for that global coalition. But that said, there was a distinct, you know, what we would call as a fascist movement. Really, the first one to impact national politics was the Klan, which was a mass movement in the 20s, a middle-class movement that helped to usher in significant immigration restriction in the United States and the first immigration quotas in the United States. These helped to create the category of the illegal alien, which didn't exist before that, right? And then you also have, in this very early days, the American Legion. In the veterans organization, you know, didn't stay a fascist organization, but, and it's, you know, founded in 1919, it was in its early days, it was explicitly praising Mussolini's Black Shirts, which also started as a veterans organization as well. So, and that was also very influential too. And there's other movements, you know, that kind of, the important thing also to remember about fascism in the U.S. is that, you know, anti-fascism has become a kind of common sense now, and that really kind of took place in World War II, but that wasn't really always the case, right? There was not, before World War II and before Pearl Harbor, there wasn't a consensus that this thing called fascism was a bad thing.
So you were talking about the rebirth of the Klan in the 1920s, and I would guess that many people, certainly some people, would think that that was a uniquely Southern movement, and in fact it was not. It was a national movement. Mm-hmm. There were Klan chapters in New England, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that. So it wasn't simply this, you know, antiquated thing from the post-Civil War South.
Absolutely. It was, and the original, the second Klan, I won't say the original Klan, but this, when it was a mass movement in the 20s, ground zero for the Klan was Indiana, in places
really?
Like Ohio, Oregon. You know, the South was part of it, you know, for sure. But what people often forget is their animus in the 20s was directed less at African Americans or people of color than it was against Catholics and Italian immigrants and East European immigrants and Jews, which they saw as, you know, voting in mass numbers. There were, because you had a massive immigration wave in the United States around the turn of the century of people from Italy, of Eastern Europe, all these places, and it was a backlash, middle American backlash against that immigration that was aiming to kind of curtail that immigration and to say, like, you know, this is contaminating good blood, red-blooded American values.
Where does that, so it's sort of consistent, I guess, with fascist movements more generally, is this aversion, this rejection of the other. Why is that such a central feature in fascist ideology?
Well, I would say because it's a central feature of Western life, right? So this is the roots of racism, right? Whenever you have a dominant culture in which white identity is a thing, in which you have racial hierarchies, which really kind of might want to date modern racism as we know it really to the 17th and 18th centuries with the rise of capitalism. whenever you have these, a broader culture in which racial identity is a thing, you have individuals and movements that would, in which it's possible for people to over-identify with that dominant ideology, right? So, yeah, short answer.
So, again, I'm totally fascinated by this era in this part of American history. In the 1920s and into the 30s, there was a very strong eugenics movement. Carrie Buck, of course, would be the epitome of that movement. Was there an overlay or a dovetailing with fascism and the Klan at that time with eugenics?
Just for anybody who's listening or watching who maybe doesn't know, eugenics, of course, is...
Eugenics is a breed of scientific racism that never fully died, that was institutionalized in the United States, in which you're seeing certain groups as biologically inferior to others, and you promote a policy in which you are creating good genes and suppressing bad genes, which are racially marked, of course. You know, the good genes are always white, you know, and Native and Protestant and things that are coded as that. And the bad genes are people of color and immigrants and all of that.
And so, people with developmental disabilities,
yes,
as in the case of Carrie Buck, who was developmentally disabled.
Yeah, but that's always been a component of American fascism, but it's not always, but it's not the central thing, right? The central thing is this this almost demonic investment in hierarchy, social hierarchy. And it's important to remember that fascism typically has been a middle class movement, not a working class movement, historically. In its various strands throughout the U.S. history, and that was true of Germany and Italy as well in the 20s and 30s.
So, if we're talking about a history of fascist movements, is there a history of anti-fascism as well?
Oh, yeah. And that's the, at least of the book, that's the kind of happy side of this, is that there's been a very strong set of anti-fascist currents in the United States. You know, since the 1920s, that were born really in Italian immigrant communities, mostly amongst Italian socialists, but you know, in the 30s, they really exploded into vast movements of the political left and liberals and a coalition and moderates as well around what we might term a set of anti-fascist politics that were aimed at the root of fascism. And you've had consistently American movements and American individuals trying to do their best to curb these fascist currents in American political life. And they have tempered. They have had palpable effects throughout, up into the current day. So that's something that's very important to remember in this story, too, is that while as fascism has been the U.S., so has anti-fascism, you know, in equal, if not larger, measure.
So let's bring this to contemporary times. You've said that President Trump brings together a fascist rhetoric, but doesn't command a properly fascist party. Mm-hmm. What are you saying when you state that?
I'm saying if you look at Trump on the campaign trail, particularly this last summer, he seems to have unconsciously stumbled and rediscovered a very old fascist rhetoric in the sense that he has all of these emotional triggers and emotional buzzwords, this rhetoric and this language that's around nation, race, violence, that's very hyper-masculine in character, and that is explicitly anti-democratic or implicitly anti-democratic and authoritarian. So what's striking if you watch Trump's speeches throughout, it's striking that words like liberty, freedom, democracy just are not even there, or certainly not equality, too. But, and those words are abused in American political life all the time, but when they disappear, it's striking. But the other side of that is that he doesn't command a properly, fascist party. The Republican Party is not, by definition, a fascist party. And it's not clear that even as president, he would need a fascist state to do what he needs to do, or that he would be able to create a fascist state, given the fact that things like free speech and free press are kind of expected in American life. I'm not rested assured that that will forever be the case, right? But for the time being, it would take a lot for someone to actually overturn these established traditions in the United States. But it's not impossible either.
So you have some confidence in our institutions?
Somewhat.
Yeah. We need to take a moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this program can be heard 3 times each weekend on SiriusXM's popular Politics of the United States, the POTUS Channel 124. Our show is produced each week by a remarkable crew at Rhode Island PBS. My name is Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. You can find me on Twitter at JM Lutis. My co-host every week is G. Wayne Miller from the Providence Journal. You can find Wayne on Twitter at G. Wayne Miller. And this week's guest is the Director of American Studies at the University of Connecticut and author of Haunted by Hitler, Dr. Christopher Viles. So, Chris, you know, there's a lot that I want to follow up on here. But
there really is a lot here.
Yeah. Does this fascist, anti-fascist, do these competing narratives play out in popular culture?
Yes, contemporarily and in the past. There has been in popular culture in the United States ever since Sinclair Lewis's 1935, It Can't Happen Here, there's been a strand of literature, a strand of movies, a strand of even TV series that imagine a fascist dystopia in the United States and what that would look like, right? And so that begins with Sinclair Lewis's It Can't Happen Here. There's been more contemporary novels that imagine this, including Philip Roth's Plot Against America. There's the Hulu series right now, The Handmaid's Tale. There was The Man in the High Castle, based on Philip Dick.
Oh, right.
That's one strand of this. And another strand of kind of literature and culture looks at, far-right kind of militia movements and fascist movements and tries to examine and the undercurrents of the psychology that leads to that. And Rod Serling in The Twilight Zone, who was a World War II vet and Jewish American, consistently went back to anti-fascism and was obsessed with fascism and the possibility that it would emerge in American life. And that was a leitmotif through The Twilight Zone, through his early television work. And so he to me was like my interest in anti-fascism in American life began with actually Rod Serling.
Really?
And seeing some of his stuff on The Twilight Zone, in which he was imagining there was a great episode called He's Alive, starring a very young Dennis Hopper, in which Dennis Hopper is this American native-born fascist, right? And he speaks in these tones that were common to the American far right in the early 1960s, which was based around Goldwater and all these things. So that, I think that's important. Those shows have played a role in maintaining an anti-fascist consciousness, right? There's been, somewhat fascist currents too, but I think at least in television, books, novels, literature, and popular culture, the anti-fascist current has been stronger than the fascist current.
Any ideas why?
I think there, at least in the 20th century, there are more artists and writers who are like liberal and left than there are far right. Mm-hmm. You know, the far right just doesn't produce that much art and literature. It does some, but not as much.
You use the word somewhat to describe your confidence that institutions, established democratic institutions, would prevent the actual rise of fascism in real life, not in The Twilight Zone or The Man in the High Castle. Why did you use the word somewhat?
Because institutions are never stable, right? And they're always dynamic and always in flux. And if anything saves us, I think the anti-fascist tradition, not just in the US, but anywhere, shows this. It's not institutions so much as it is people and organizing and political organizing and meeting fascism in the street and confronting the roots of fascism through anti-racist work, through all kinds of work aimed against discrimination. But one of the things that's with anti-fascism, there was a phrase in the American League Against War and Fascism in the 1930s, which was the biggest anti-fascist umbrella group then. And they had, one of their speakers at a conference had said this thing that was very memorable that I found in the archives, which was, whether or not America goes fascist depends on who gets organized first. So to me, it's about countering something like fascism, yes, institutions help. But really, it's about being organized and being active in your community, and it's contingent on people being active and being out there and being vocal that prevents the institutional erosion that would lead to fascism.
So if we think about the first 6 months of 2017, are there episodes that give you cause for concern, and are there episodes on the other side that give you cause for confidence?
Yeah, I mean, there was a moment really early on in the Trump presidency when there was the court basically ordered, the federal courts had ordered him to stop the immigration ban.
The travel ban.
And there was some rumors circulating around that immigration officials and you know, the Department of Homeland Security was supposed to be taking orders from the president and not the courts. But he backed off. And that moment, I felt we were really close. What if he would have just said, well, the hell with the courts?
Right.
And then you're basically talking about military backing. Then you're talking about, well, the military and the police back him up, right? And there was that moment was really terrifying. But what was also inspiring and really in the tradition of American fascism, as anti-fascism as well, were all the people who showed up to the airports,
yeah.
You know, and who protested.
Left their homes on a Saturday afternoon to go to the,
right.
to the airports and protest.
Exactly, and said, this is not in our name. You're not going to get away with this. And, you know, my wife also, she does work on Asian American history, and you know, one of the things that she stressed was that this mass movement did not happen when Japanese Americans were incarcerated, right? And you do have that. So that's a source of the, even though multiculturalism and multicultural education has its problems, the fact that that was institutionalized after civil rights helps. And I think it does help to actually get people out there and motivate them to kind of combat an anti-immigrant politics.
So you talked earlier about what ordinary people, citizens, can do who might be concerned about this. And this marching, this talking to your representatives, is mm-hmm. taking an active role in your democracy. What beyond that can you do? And a second part of the question is, you know, should we still be vigilant? Or has the threat passed and now we're moving into a golden future? I think I kind of know the answer to that, but let's hear you give it.
It's not passed at all. And when Trump is talking about firing Mueller, right, that is actually something that frightens me as well, right? So, and that's, no, the danger is never passed. The danger will not be, Trump will not be president forever.
Eternal vigilance is the price of liberty, right?
Right. But in terms of what people can do, I mean, there's implicit and explicit anti-fascism. I think with the explicit, there's the kind of the quote-unquote anti-fas, the people who actually confront, like far-right violent groups in the streets. That's one thing. But then I would say that anytime somebody does anti-racist work in which you are trying to build a society in which immigrants, even undocumented immigrants, are seen as people and not social pariahs, you're doing implicitly anti-fascist work. Anytime you try to build anybody who tries to build a society in which hyper-masculine kind of aggression is not acceptable, whether it's in the form of bullying in schools, whether in form of targeting women and LGBT people, anytime that someone does that work, it's implicitly anti-fascist, right? So I think there's a lot of ways that you can go about, and also trying to create an economy in which does not generate so much inequality and generates so much economic anxiety that forms the kind of roots and the seedbed of fascism as well. Anytime you focus on any of those things or engage in any of those activities, I think you're being implicitly anti-fascist.
Are you, should we be concerned that the lexicon that we've used around the table today, fascism and anti-fascism, is not part of the popular discourse? I think that some of these things are happening and most Americans are blithely unaware that these are the forces, these are the historic forces that we're grappling with and mm-hmm. frankly playing dangerously with.
Mm-hmm.
Are you concerned about that?
Yeah, I am. I mean, it's one thing when I first started writing the book, there was an idea that fascism and anti-fascism, these terms weren't fully legible in American politics and American political life, and you sounded like a little bit of a crazy person to even talk about them. But I'm not really getting that anymore, which is kind of scary. You know, I would like to be seen as a crazy person. I think that would be helpful.
Be reassuring.
Right. And yeah, I think I am half the time anyway, but like universally so, that would be reassuring. But no, with it's striking to me, like even the term Antifa, which used to be something that was legible in Germany and in Europe, starts to be, even that term seems to be a little bit more mainstream now. Even the guy who shot the three people in Oregon on the train last week said in a conference, death to Antifa, right? That term is coming out. Or the way in which mainstream commentators are not shying away from the term fascism when they're talking about Trump, when they're talking about some of Trump's supporters. Even when I was writing the book, left and liberal people and moderates were kind of not using that vocabulary anymore.
Well, you're kind of uncomfortable with it because I think that we so heavily associate fascism simply with Hitler.
Right.
Yes, and Mussolini.
That's sort of a way to take yourself out of a serious political debate is to accuse your opponent of being the next Hitler.
And the left overused it. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Once you mentioned The Twilight Zone and The Man in the High Castle, I got thinking. And I thought of The Hunger Games, which
is one
of the blockbuster franchises in movie history and so forth and so on. What is the fascination for creative people, for the writers and the directors and the actors, to use fascism as their central narrative? In all the, you know, The Twilight Zone was a hit series. Hunger Games, big, and we could go through a long list. Mm-hmm. What is it? Why are we fascinated with this?
Well, I mean, because you see, it's an active thing, right? Right? But it's not a set of dinosaurs. It's not fully a set of ghosts. I don't want to say that these are necessarily the best narratives of engaging fascist currents, but they play a role. But there's a pessimism I think that drives it, which is that this is where we could go. This is where society could go if we continue down this path, right? And that's driving on kind of all dystopian narratives, right? But I think part of that in contemporary popular culture is there's a larger draw to dystopian narratives, zombies, all of these kind of things that are ubiquitous now. And it's important to remember that the whole claim, make America great again, there is a reality to the fact that living standards used to be better in this country. Wages since about the mid-70s have stagnated or declined through Democrat and Republican presidents, and levels of indebtedness are much higher. Dystopia seems a little bit more like reality than utopia to imagine in this particular type of environment.
Well, unfortunately, that's the point we've got to leave it on. Chris Viles, thank you so much for being with us. The book is Haunted by Hitler. We want to thank all of you for joining us this week and every week on Story in the Public Square. If you want to know more about this program, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or visit pellcenter.org, where you can also catch up on previous episodes. For G. Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis, asking you to join us again next week for more Story in the Public Square.